Welcome back to the third hour of Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're going to spend this hour on several subjects. A bit of potpourri. Yesterday, a judge in California decided that California's ban on gay marriage, the definition of marriage as one man, one woman, was unconstitutional. And we're going to talk about that ruling, what brought it about, and where it might lead with Randy Thomason here in just a few minutes on Issues Etc. from the Campaign for Children and Families based in Sacramento, California. Dorothy Timms joins us from National Right to Life in a few minutes to get an update on Terry Schindler Schiavo. After the last hour's conversation, you might be curious as to what lies ahead for Terry. The clock is ticking, and I'm wondering what's happening to that bill in the House and Senate that seemed to have been the last legal effort to save Terry's life from her guardian husband, Michael Schiavo. We'll find out about that then in the last 25 minutes of the program. If you're familiar with the Far Side cartoon, I don't think I'm dating anyone in that respect. 1994, Larson stopped drawing the thing, but by the time he was finished, he had produced just hundreds and hundreds of comic strips in the newspapers and books all over the place, so widely syndicated. Almost 2,000 newspapers, I believe, carried this comic strip. Why would we be talking about a comic strip? Well, our guest in the last 25 minutes, Dr. Patrick Gray of Rhodes College, contends that this comic strip, when it dealt with the issues of God, heaven, and hell, was more reflective of the real opinions and beliefs of Americans about God, heaven, and hell than any religious poll. We'll find out what those beliefs are in the last 25 minutes of Issues Etc. Our call-in numbers, as we discuss California's ban on gay marriage and the possibility that that ban may be overturned, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Randy Thomason is with us. He's president of Campaign for Children and Families based in Sacramento, California. Randy, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Hey, Todd. It's good to be with you.
What did the judge decide yesterday, and how did his decision come about?
The judge attacked marriage and the voters. He said that he's going to create homosexual marriage, and he's going to strike down the vote of the people that protected marriage for a man and a woman. And he did it by a very illogical means. It was almost a torturous read as Judge Richard Kramer of San Francisco spent basically 27 pages to say that he finds no rational basis for protecting marriage for a man and a woman. He ignored a natural law that says a man and a woman are absolutely required to conceive and birth a child. He ignored all of the bulk of social science evidence, which says that a man and a woman are the best environment for children, educationally, health-wise, financially, etc. He ignored what the Constitution of California says about the vote of the people, that the Constitution says when the people vote for something, you can't overturn that. He exploded the word or the words equal protection and made them say what they never meant. He uses the word equality basically to say that there should be an equal right of homosexuals to have marriage. Now, he didn't establish sexual orientation or sexual preference as a strict scrutiny class, raising it to the level of race directly, but he did it indirectly. He said that limiting marriage to a man and a woman creates, quote, a gender-based classification. And then he said that smacks of separate but equal and is like the racial discrimination in the schools or the ban on interracial marriage years ago. And he basically threw it out on that basis. He opined this ruling is an opinion, and it's a liberal one. He's the first judge in America that has attacked and thrown out the vote of the people on marriage. So he's even done worse than the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court.
Randy, here is Dennis Herrera. He is San Francisco city attorney reacting to Judge Kramer's decision.
It's time to leave discrimination in the background. This country is changing. We are moving ahead, we are moving for the better, and we recognize that it's in all of our interests to promote the most just of societies that protect the civil rights of all individuals.
Randy, your reaction to Herrera's comments there.
Let me say what he should have said. We need to put thievery behind us. We need to protect what is natural and good and beneficial for the children. We need to respect God and country, and we need to respect the people's vote. And we need to protect marriage for a man and a woman as is natural and as is best for the environment of raising children. We have got to do that because if we call something special and good and yet then undefine it, we no longer have something that's special and good. We have nothingness. And we must stand for the children, the voters, and the Constitution, and we must stand against bad politicians and bad judges who impose their own agenda, breaking the law and breaking up the natural order of things.
Think
I could get elected as district attorney of San Francisco?
Doubt it.
Yeah, I don't think so.
Here's Kate Kendall. She's executive director of the National Center for Lesbian Rights, reacting to the judge's decision.
It is clear that the day is passing when it is appropriate to single out a category of human beings in this country for special discrimination and for special disability on their families and on their relationships.
What do you make of her reaction there, Randy?
She's playing the victim while she's victimizing others. She's victimizing marriage. She's victimizing the voters. And she's victimizing the children. You cannot call something special if you make it unspecial. Marriage is about oneness, not about sameness. And we must say, yeah, we'd like time to pass behind us. We'd like something to end. And we'd like the apathy of people of faith to end. We'd like pastors to get away from being people pleasers and become God pleasers and introduce more tough love activism into church services. There's a huge majority called the silent majority in America who are willing to be trained to be moral agents of truth. But it's going to depend upon leadership, and it's going to depend upon people saying, I want to make a difference, in order for truly the paralysis of the past and the apathy of the past to come to an end.
California has a very healthy tradition of referenda, people voting on the laws that affect them on a day-to-day basis. You have mentioned several times here that it was the people's vote that was in many ways ignored by Judge Kramer's decision yesterday when he declared the ban on gay marriage unconstitutional. Tell us about that vote.
5 years ago, March 7, 2000, 61.4% of Californians passed Proposition 22, which was called the Protection of Marriage Initiative. I had the privilege of delivering that language to our Secretary of State's office when it was initially filed on behalf of the late Senator Pete Knight. And the 14 words of Proposition 22 said it all. It said, quote, only marriage between a man and a woman is valid or recognized in California. The vote of the people to comprehensively protect marriage as a natural institution between a man and a woman, struck down by a judge who says he's above the people. Well, you know what? You can't find homosexual marriage in the California Constitution or the federal Constitution. In fact, I can't find it in any constitution in the United States. But he apparently had special glasses on. I guess when you live in San Francisco, you get special glasses that make you see truth as lies and make you see conservative values as liberal.
Is there any indication of what Governor Schwarzenegger, what his position might be on this, if only by way of influence?
Well, the governor has shifted around quite a bit on this. Governor Schwarzenegger is a liberal Republican governor. And he has said at one time that it's okay with him if the courts or the people change their minds on marriage. It's definitely not okay with me if the courts change our minds on marriage. He said yesterday that he's against, quote, gay marriage. But if he won't lift a finger to oppose it, you got to wonder the value of his words. The governor should actually announce right now that he would veto AB 19, the homosexual marriage license bill, if it reached his desk. That is our real direction here in our state. We can't call the judge, and we can't do much about the judge except to appeal the ruling, which we're doing right now, and doing a lot of media interviews. I've done about 20 media interviews in the last 24 hours, and you know, we are exposing the judge and this crazy ruling. And we hope that the state Supreme Court gets a clue that they should overrule him in the year and a half when the case reaches there. But the people's anger and the people's shock were directing in the fight against the homosexual marriage license bill, AB 19, which is introduced in our state legislature here by 25 Democrat politicians. This is what the Democrat Party in California and nationally is becoming more and more, the homosexual marriage party. And we are telling people, call, write, email, all through our website, saveamerica.net. Saveamerica.net is where, if you're not in California, you can actually donate to our cause, because we are unashamed in saying we need help to protect America from California.
Randy Thomason is president of Campaign for Children and Families based in Sacramento, California. We're talking about the judge's ruling yesterday against California's ban on gay marriage. One quick question before we go. How likely is it that California will, like Massachusetts, have court enforced, all the way to the Supreme Court of the state, court enforced gay marriage in the future?
I say it's a 50-50 shot. There was a 4-3 decision in Massachusetts. 4 bad, 3 good. Here in California, we got a 7-member state Supreme Court. It could go 4-3 either way. I'm not sure. I would hope that it would be 5 good and 2 bad. I really think that people need to cry out right now to God for his mercy, to protect marriage for a man and a woman as he has created it. Part of crying out to God is asking God to forgive our personal and societal disobedience. Truthfully, we probably all belong to churches that in some way are men pleasers more than God pleasers. We ourselves can give just lip service to God. I know I have in my life. And we need to really have repentance be part of our prayers, and then we need to act by giving of our resources, giving of our time, sending an email, visiting our website, saveamerica.net, calling legislators in your state legislature, no matter where you live, and say, protect marriage for a man and a woman, telling your pastor, please speak out on this Sunday, and direct the people of what they can do. We've got to have an active faith. We've got to have our deeds match our words. And we can't just say, oh, this is a terrible thing done by a judge in San Francisco. You know, I struggle to say that God is blessing America. I think we're getting sort of what we deserve because America has disregarded God so many times.
Randy Thomason is president of Campaign for Children and Families based in Sacramento. The website, saveamerica.net, Campaign for Children and Families based in Sacramento. Randy, thank you for being our guest.
Well, thank you very much. Good to be with you.
For the remainder of this half hour, we're going to be talking with Dorothy Timms. She is from National Right to Life. She is a legislative counsel for the Robert Powell Center for Medical Ethics for National Right to Life. And we're going to get an update on Terry Schindler Schiavo. We mentioned in a previous conversation here on the program that the clock is definitely ticking, as it has been for Terry. Dorothy, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thank you for having me.
What is the latest now for Terry Schindler Schiavo? Dorothy's phone is breaking out. We'll see if we can bring her back here in just a moment. Folks, if you'd like to join our conversation, feel free to do so. 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. I believe she must have been on a cell phone there. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, and we will try to get her back. In the meantime, Christ Academy 2005 is a 2-week residential program for young men in high school who are interested, maybe even only passingly interested, in a future in the pastoral ministry in the Lutheran Church and Missouri Synod. It's a 2-week chance to go to classes, go to chapel, interact with real seminary students and real seminary faculty, and get a real taste of what it's like to study for the pastoral ministry. This may be the seed that you can plant by sponsoring a young man. The registration cost is $450 for this 2-week residential program in Fort Wayne. This may be the seed that you can plant for a young man that may make him a pastor in the future and serve God's people through the preaching of God's word and the administration of the sacraments. Think about that when you look around your congregation at those high school aged men. For more information on Christ Academy 2005, go to our website. There's a logo and a link for Christ Academy 2005, or call Concordia Theological Seminary, 1-800-481-2155, 1-800-481-2155. Dorothy Timms is with us again, from National Right to Life Legislative Council for the Robert Powell Center for Medical Ethics for National Right to Life. Dorothy, welcome.
Thank you.
What is happening with Terry as we speak?
Well, as we speak, Bobby Schindler, her brother, is lobbying the halls of Congress. We're focusing primarily today on the Senate side. Believe it or not, we feel like the Senate is more prone to move first on this bill. We feel strong. We feel confident about it. We have reason to believe that we could actually see this pass in both chambers by the end of the week.
All right. Tell us about the law that you're discussing here. We've discussed it here on the air, and some people have called it the very last legal avenue for Terry.
It quite possibly could be the very last hope for Terry and her family. This is a law that is just going to provide a most basic level of due process, the same level of due process that we provide for convicted felons like John Wayne Gacy and Ted Bundy. Just an additional hearing to ensure that their process rights have not been violated.
Is it, as some critics have said, this is a law written for simply one person? Does it have ramifications beyond Terry's particular situation?
Well, I think currently the bill is applicable. It would be generally applicable to anyone who finds themselves in this vulnerable position, someone who's incapacitated, who does not have a written directive, and whose family members dispute the so-called oral directive to remove food and water.
Now, Terry is at this point surviving because of a stay. Judge Greer has permitted a stay. When does that run out, and what will it mean if nothing is done between now and the stay's termination?
The stay will be lifted, and March 18th, the judge has ordered to remove water from her feeding tube, which means that this bill will have to pass both the House and the Senate and be signed into law in order for her to have access to this federal court, this fresh forum, to review the facts of this case.
Now, you mentioned that the Senate looks more hopeful for initially considering this bill. What's it look like in the House?
Well, we feel confident about the House. We really are trying to get the Senate to move on it just in terms of the calendar. The Senate might be more prone to act on it, and that might motivate the House to move quickly. Unfortunately, both chambers are going out for recess on Friday, and so we're really looking at tomorrow and Thursday to get this done. It's difficult to say at this point how it's going to play out, but we feel like we have a lot of support in chambers, so that's great.
What has the president said with regard to signing this bill, should it make it through both chambers?
I'm not aware of a statement from the White House as of yet. However, I would confidently say that he would likely sign such a bill.
Dorothy, is there anything else? I mean, we've talked about it already here about kind of the last-ditch effort. Is there anything else? Many minds have been put to trying to save Terry's life beyond this federal bill.
Well, in fact, there is. The Florida legislature is acting on a piece of legislation, which, unfortunately, I can't comment on all the details of that, but I know that it relates to an informed consent standard that would apply to Terry, and requiring a basic level of informed consent, which we believe, if, in fact, she did consent, which that is disputed, it wasn't an informed one, a casual comment would suffice for such a drastic order to remove food and fluids without truly understanding the ramifications of such a statement. So there's that going on. Level. We don't know whether that would apply to Terry, given that there is a final court order. So we're going to move forward here on the federal. We do still need all the listeners out there to be calling their representatives. Many are not yet on board. Many are on board, but we need the groundswell of listeners.
And then on that issue of people who are getting on board, the St. Louis Post-Dispatch just yesterday had a story about the ability of pro-life forces to mobilize around this issue, and in particular the subtitle, Massive Media Campaign Isolates Husband, that's Michael Schiavo, on Feeding Tube Issue. How successful is this campaign being for kind of bringing attention to this and showing Michael Schiavo's intent to have his wife's food and water removed for what it is?
We're kind of breaking up there, I'm sorry.
Okay, let me try it one more time.
All right.
There's news about a massive media campaign that is focusing on Terry and mobilizing the pro-life community. Are you seeing this kind of mobilization?
Well, we are absolutely seeing the grassroots that are very aware of what's going on, and they're sharing the news, and people are just...
All right, now I think she's permanently gone. Oh, there she is.
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Well, it's unfortunate that her brother Bobby has to spend his time here, all the precious time with his sister Terry. And so, you know, the fact that the grassroots had a tremendous impact. Many of the congressmen are responding to these calls. I think the grassroots are really what makes things happen in this country, especially on this issue.
So what specifically should our listeners do?
Specifically, they should find out their representatives, find out their congressmen. Of course, if they're from Florida, they need to be calling their representatives. But nationwide, you know, it doesn't matter what state you're from. Even if you feel like they're already on board, call them and thank them for being on board. If you don't know, you can always office and ask, send faxes, emails, anything at this point. We're just up against a crucial deadline here, and this is almost unheard of to push something through so quickly.
Dorothy Timms is legislative counsel for the Robert Powell Center for Medical Ethics for National Right to Life, giving us an update on Terry Schindler-Shivo and that all-important law at the federal level trying to make its way through both chambers and to the president's desk for a signature. Dorothy, thank you for being our guest.
Thank you for having me.
You know, it's one person, folks. I mean, one person. They say there is this obscure woman in Florida, and of course the media has a way of just magnifying these things like a big fishbowl, and maybe it's being blown out of proportion. And maybe you're one of those who says, you know, I'm just tired of hearing about Terry Schindler-Shivo. We have listeners who are probably tired of hearing about Terry Schindler-Shivo. No, is it overkill to try and mount a federal effort to pass a law that would stay, really, her execution at the hands of her, at least at the will of her husband and guardian? I think so. Can you spend too much time talking, especially when you're down to 1 or 2 days for something like this to actually occur? And it may be the last-ditch effort. Can you spend too much time talking about it? No. We're talking about saving a life. You say, I'm pro-life. But I'm tired of hearing about Terry Schindler-Shivo. You know what? I'm tired of talking about it, too. But sometimes... In the effort to protect life from beginning to end, to defend life from beginning to end, we keep talking and we keep listening. If Terry were your daughter, if you were the Schindlers, the parents, by the way, and watching your daughter suffer this and everything she suffered for the last decade at the negligence of her husband and guardian, and now, to top it all off, it appears as though he has won the legal battle to have her starved to death and have her water taken away from her. And if you were down to 2.5 days and then within the end of the week, Friday, that process would finally begin for not the first or the second, but the third time his attempts to have his wife starved to death, I think you'd want people talking about it and listening about it as well. When we come back, we'll continue Issues, Etc.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
What elements does a sermon need to be considered a law gospel sermon? What did the Apostle Paul mean when he told the Corinthians, "We preach Christ crucified"? Our Issues, Etc. book of the month for March is titled Selected Sermons of Norman Nagel. You can read sermons preached by one of our most popular guests, Dr. Norman Nagel of Concordia Seminary in St. Louis. Visit our website, issuesetc.org, for more information on selected sermons of Norman Nagel. Or call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. Selected sermons of Norman Nagel cost $24.99 plus shipping and handling. 1-800-325-3040. Jesus, Jesus, and More Jesus in our Issues, Etc. book of the month for March. Selected Sermons of Norman Nagel. 1-800-325-3040 or issuesetc.org. Fans of our sermon evaluation series will appreciate Selected Sermons of Norman Nagel, our Issues, Etc. book of the month for March.
If you question evolution, you might get fired.
Answers with Ken Ham, a former public school biology teacher. Ken, a few weeks ago you reported that a biology instructor was in danger of losing his job because he refused to teach evolution as a fact. Whatever happened there?
Well, Dr. Kevin Haley was a popular biology instructor at a community college in Oregon. Now, he candidly admits that he was teaching his college students the problems with evolution. By all accounts, Dr. Haley never taught creation in his classes, but because he implied it by criticizing evolution, that was enough to get him dismissed. Now, Dr. Haley is highly qualified. He holds a doctorate in biology from respected Purdue University, and his former department chairman called him an excellent teacher. We even got a hold of some of the evaluations written by his students, and it appears he was an extremely popular instructor. You know, I find it simply amazing that with this kind of background, a professor can lose his college position simply because he doesn't teach evolution dogmatically. Remember, he didn't even bring up creation in his classes. By the way, where were the so-called civil liberties groups that should be rallying to Dr. Haley's side to defend his academic freedom? They didn't show up. Academic freedom, to evolutionists, is to be free from creation and God's word.
There are hundreds of creation scientists worldwide who hold doctorate degrees like Dr. Haley. You can find a partial list of them by going to our website, answersradio.com.
This is Dr. John Tape with the Media Minute. The latest brain research shows that the front part of the brain is responsible for self-control and moral judgment. This part of the brain develops through childhood and adolescence. The American Academy of Pediatrics reports some research has suggested that mindless television may idle this particular part of the brain and impoverish its development. So how much TV can our children watch? Again, the American Academy of Pediatrics says 1 hour a day is a lot for preschoolers, and 1 to 2 hours is the maximum for older children. Motivated by God's love, which He has shown us in Jesus, we can place limits on our children and their TV time. This Media Minute is brought to you by the Christian Media Literacy Institute. Please visit our website at cmli.org.
Hi, this is Paul Clayton inviting you to wake up with Word and Song. Mornings on AM 850 KFUO. You'll hear inspirational Christian favorites from folks like Avalon, Mercy Me, and Bebo Norman. Messages from the hosts of Front Porch Parenting, The Meyer Minute, and Creation Moment. Conversations with Dr. Jack Fiennes, Ruth Cook, Dr. Bob Weiss, Jane Wilkie, and Marty Linfett. And devotionals from Pastors Mark Hawkinson, John Schmidtke, and even St. Peter. Start your day with Jesus in your heart and His Word on your mind on AM 850 KFUO.
Welcome back. In the last 25 minutes of Issues, Etc., God, Heaven, Hell, all in the comic strip, The Far Side. I was a big fan. Hasn't been actively published for 10 years. Gary Larson, probably one of the funniest guys out there in terms of what he put in the papers, some 2,000 papers at the height of its publication. This little comic strip with one panel, it's funny. How often the themes were religious. Now, the pollsters go out on a regular basis. There are entire organizations that do nothing but poll the American public on their religious views, their spiritual ideas and beliefs. You can read those polls and you sometimes get a rosy picture of what people believe. Oh, everybody believes in God, or practically everybody, and most of those apparently believe in heaven and maybe hell. And then things fall off pretty quickly. Could it be that a little bit of pop culture like The Far Side is a better indicator of what we really believe and think about issues of God, heaven, and hell than all of those polls and their results? Dr. Patrick Gray joins us here on Issues, Etc. to discuss that. He teaches in the Department of Religious Studies at Rhodes College in Memphis, Tennessee, and he's author of an article in the latest issue of Touchstone Magazine titled Comic Belief. Dr. Gray, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Hi, how are you?
Very well. For those who maybe have not ever seen the little flip calendars or the books or the republication in newspapers of this little comic strip, The Far Side, reintroduce us to this thing.
Yeah, if they haven't seen those items or the coffee mugs or the refrigerator magnets or the T-shirts, it was quite a cottage industry and continues to be so. I think you could say that Gary Larson's The Far Side was perhaps the most popular comic strip of the last quarter of the 20th century. I mean, you talked about how many newspapers, about 2,000 newspapers it was syndicated in, translated in several languages, and it still makes big bucks to this day. Not really a comic strip, since it's just one panel with not a very sophisticated drawing and just a one-line caption. Very surreal, topsy-turvy, kind of crazy world that people just immediately took to. It was very different from any comic strips that appeared before it, and the ones that have tried to imitate it in the time since it was stopped about 10 years ago, nothing's been quite as successful.
Well, I'll tell you, personally, as a fan of the comic strip for almost its entire run, the panels that I found sometimes most intriguing, most amusing, and sometimes most enlightening were the ones that dealt with religious, explicitly religious themes, heaven, hell, and God. How much of Larson's material was drawn from that font?
Quite a bit, actually. I had the idea to write this article from looking at a colleague's office door in the Department of Religious Studies here, and it was covered with comic strips. Most of them were from the Far Side about religion. So right after I noticed that, I decided to buy the newly published complete Far Side, where every single Far Side strip was published. This was about a year ago, and this is I can't vouch for the complete accuracy of this, but of the 4,000 or so strips he published, about 6 months' worth of material was devoted to something you might call a religious theme or topic. And that's not counting something like the Grim Reaper, which you could argue is a religious subject, but that's quite a bit, 6 months' worth.
Now, that might just be considered par for the course in American pop entertainment. Religion always finds its way in there because it's part of the fabric of our culture. However, you say that it may be more indicative, what you would see in these little panels in the newspaper or in the books, this may be more indicative about what Americans really believe about God, heaven, and hell. Tell us about it.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you talked about the public opinion polls, and you always have to be cautious with those. You can come up with any result you want to if you word the questions the right way. And also, you know, people might mean different things by the word God or heaven and hell when you ask if you believe in God or heaven or hell. So you got to look for other ways to kind of take the spiritual pulse, so to speak, of the nation. And when I was going through this this massive publication that Larson put out, he and his editors talked about the process they went through in deciding how a certain strip should appear. They didn't want to lose the audience through being too obscure, or they didn't want to offend the audience's sensibilities. And they also published a lot of letters that readers sent in asking for clarification or expressing dismay over this or that. So based on their own description of that process, I think, and based on the success, I mean, you can't argue with success. I think they did a pretty good job of communicating or you know, resonating with the public in a way that didn't offend them, didn't lose them, and kept them laughing for about 15 years.
So if we were to permit for a moment that the Far Side comic strip might be one way of taking a more accurate pulse when it comes to issues like God, heaven, and hell, let's take those one at a time. Who is the God of American belief if one looked at it through the window of the Far Side comic strip?
Well, there's a lot of debate today about whether we're a so-called Christian nation, but if you were to base it on what you see in the comic page, I mean, we're a pretty Judeo-Christian country, albeit in a confused way sometimes, but when Gary Larson writes about God, he doesn't really feel the need to explain what he has in mind, and you can tell pretty quickly from the way God is portrayed that it's, again, in sort of a vague way, this is the God of the Bible. Sure, we're a lot more diverse than we used to religiously, socially, ethnically, but when people say God, unless they explain in more detail, people assume you're talking about the God of the Bible.
What I'm curious about is, and I've got a copy of the complete Far Side, I got it for Christmas, and I read through the preliminary material and then kind of fell out to read something else. And I didn't take a survey of it. But since you looked at every panel, was Jesus ever a subject in any of these?
That's a good question. I may be the only person ever who's read through the entire work of Gary Farside, specifically looking for religious references. And there was a total of one reference to Jesus that I could find. It was just a panel of, it was Jesus holding the rein of a horse, walking on water, and a voice coming from heaven saying, Jesus, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him walk on it. I think is what it was.
That's pretty good, actually.
Yeah, not one of the funnier ones, but it's pretty good. But that was the only specific mention of Jesus. So what can you draw from that? I'm not sure. I mean, I think people are okay with you joking about God a little bit more than with Jesus. But perhaps that avoidance of Jesus is part of a larger kind of strategy of saying we don't want to alienate or get too specific about our religion. Let's just stick with your general God rather than getting down into the nitty-gritty details.
You say, you put it this way, Larson's God is the vaguely Judeo-Christian deity of the American civil religion. What do you mean by that, American civil religion?
I think it's the kind of God that at least 75, if not 90 or 95% of the American population says they believe in. If you were to ask much more specific questions than do you believe in God, then you're going to get a lot of disagreement between different, even different Christians. You're going to get a lot of different beliefs. So we have a God who is really powerful, who's this old man with a long white beard. A little bit of a caricature. All right, well, I suppose it's a caricature. Who knows what God looks like? But this is not an offensive God.
You know, it's funny that you mentioned that caricature. We were just a couple of days ago on the program. We were listening to the recipient of the Templeton Prize for Spirituality, Charles Townes. He's the inventor of the laser and the maser, and he is famous for asking for some rapprochement between religion and science for about the last 40 years. Well, one of the things, we had a little quote from him where he said, well, I know that there's a God out there, and I pray on a regular basis, but is he a man with a long white beard in robes? No, I don't think so. It seems as though that has become the cultural icon off of which a lot of people will play. It's either the man in robes with the long white beard, or he doesn't exist at all.
Yeah, and it's not specifically American. I mean, if you go back and look at art through the centuries, he's been portrayed in that way for a long time, but while I guess we have to be wary of anthropomorphism as humans, how else? I mean, it's hard to think of God in any other way. I mean, yeah, when you get into specific descriptions of what does his what does his hair look like, then yeah, you get into kind of silly territory. But yeah, there seems to be no in between, and like you say, either there is no God or it's, such a ridiculous God that it's only fools and children would believe in it.
What about the devil? How do we have a window into the American mindset and belief about the devil in the Farside cartoons?
We're a lot more interested in him, or we find him a lot funnier. I'm not sure what to make of that, but if you take a survey there of what Larson produces, there's a lot more material devoted to the devil or hell. And so a lot of it is, again, the caricature kind of material you're talking about. You know, he's got horns, he's got a pitchfork, it's really hot down there. You're punished according to your sin. For example, Charlie Parker, the great jazz saxophonist there, has his own private hell, is listening to New Age music forever. So, again, that's not distinctively American. I mean, that goes back to Dante, and even further back than Dante. But it is a bit of a caricature. You know, when we talk about personal evil, that's a pretty orthodox Christian belief that evil is a personal kind of force, but we don't have to commit ourselves to pitchforks. And again, that's sort of a caricature, but skeptics, I think, want to perpetrate that kind of image too. It's either there is no evil or it's this caricature that you're talking about.
So we've got God and the devil. How does Larson depict heaven and hell?
In terms of heaven, you don't really see a whole lot of people enjoying God, you know, worshiping God, glorifying God, and enjoying him forever, in the words of the Westminster, Shorter Catechism, the Westminster Confession there. Talking about the chief end of man, in heaven there is not very funny to most people. Heaven is kind of boring. You know, you get this sort of village atheist kind of argument a lot. I mean, you don't get in the far side, but the idea of, well, gee, who would want to go to heaven? It seems so boring, just doing the same thing, playing a harp.
Well, that's where I think Larson is dead on when it comes to kind of tapping into the, even a lot of Christians' conceptions about heaven. Heaven is, well, it's going to have to be a great place because God says it's going to be great, but I don't see how it's going to be so great from this side of the gate, because it looks pretty boring to me.
Right, and that's the the flawed assumption that a lot of Christians have as well. Well, gee, if I, from my very limited, finite human perspective, if I can't imagine how endless life could keep from being boring, well, gee, it must be a logical impossibility. Well, that's a pretty fallacious argument right there. There may be, I mean, Christians of all people should be able to concede that we as fallen creatures can't imagine all that God might have in store for us.
Folks, I'd like to hear from you on The Far Side and its treatment of religious themes. Give us a call in the next 15 minutes, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Dr. Patrick Gray teaches in the Department of Religious Studies at Rhodes College in Memphis, Tennessee, and he's author of an article in the latest issue of Touchstone Magazine titled Comic Belief. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. You're tuned to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. All right, you have three explanations for why the jocularity, why the laughter at these really just dead serious subjects, even heaven, God, heaven, hell, the devil. Walk us through these one by one, if you would. You say the first explanation might be that fans of The Far Side are laughing because they recognize Larson's caricatures of these things for simply what they are.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to read the minds of millions of readers, but you can make some educated guesses here. And I think that for a lot of people, they laugh because they don't believe in a God or a heaven and hell. And the fact that we can joke about these things shows that we've collectively put childish things away, like belief in a literal hell. We can laugh at these things now because we see that they were part of our kind of childish beliefs that we had back then, but now we've grown up. I think for a lot of people that probably explains it. It's very unfunny to explain why things are funny. So,
Well, I'm thinking about this. I'm thinking about the person who may use the depiction of these things, God, heaven, and hell, in Larson's cartoons, to kind of be an oblique way of poking fun at those who actually still believe those things. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah. I think for a portion of the audience, I think that's right on. For most of the audience, though, I mean, like I said, you have to be cautious about trusting public opinion polls. But I believe that a good three quarters or so of the American public does say they believe in God, heaven, and hell. So for those people, that wouldn't really apply quite as much. With a lot of people, I think it's a kind of a defense mechanism. Well, gee, we say we believe in hell, but the same polls that say that 75 or more percent of us believe in hell, when you ask the question, do you believe that you are going to hell, the number drops off considerably, as you might imagine. It's less than 1% of all people believe that they are actually going to hell. So we don't like to be reminded of the fact that it's, if we say we believe in hell, that means there might be some people going there. And so that, I think, we like to not be reminded of. If we kind of ignore the question, maybe it'll go away. So like I say in the article, even among many evangelicals, among whom belief in a literal hell is most prominent. We don't get the same prevalence of the question, you know, if you were to die today, can you say without a doubt you'd go to heaven, that you wouldn't go to hell? That, when I was growing up, you didn't hear that all the time, but it was a fairly common question in evangelistic settings. People don't ask that today because that's an awkward question to ask. It makes us think about these final things in ways that might be uncomfortable.
And you offer as the third explanation for the humor here. Not that I'm opposed to the humor, but as an explanation, that perhaps it is simply true that our knowledge of these things and our beliefs about these things are very shallow indeed.
Yeah, pretty wide, but not very deep, I think. The more you think about eternal damnation or, you know, eternal separation from God, it's really not very funny. And so, if you know, the more we think about these things, I'm all for laughter. I'm not saying we shouldn't laugh at these things. I find Gary Larson hilarious, and I'm not saying that he's corrupting America. He's more or less reflecting the shallowness of a great percentage of the American public, I think. But you know, Martin Luther does talk about laughing at the devil. But he says, you know, the best way to drive out, you know, it's not for lack of belief in the devil, because Martin Luther does believe in the devil. He says that the best way to drive out the devil, quote, is to jeer and to flout him, for he cannot bear scorn. That's a different kind of laughter, though. He's talking about making the devil, making evil realize that it can't stand up to God. But this is cynical laughter, I think, that we often get with these popular descriptions.
I've thought about it. And your article made me think about it a little bit more. And let me propose a fourth alternative to why I find it funny.
Okay.
Perhaps it's funny as a counterpoint to orthodoxy. Not ridicule in the sense of ridiculing the truth, but ridiculing counterfeits of the truth. That someone who does hold to orthodox beliefs about God, heaven, and hell, and the many other things that go along with it, can afford to laugh when their joke's made, because they have it as a counterpoint point to genuine orthodoxy.
Yeah, I think if I understand you correctly, you're suggesting that for the American public, largely theistic, at least nominally Christian public, we are pretty secure or confident that there is a God, and so we can put up. We don't feel as threatened as we might be if we were a beleaguered minority. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, something along those lines. Or just personally, it is a little funny to look at the, perhaps this is laughter with tears, at the vacuousness of American belief from the vantage point of orthodoxy.
Yeah, I think you're right. If you're in a situation where you're not really sure about the belief, I mean, belief in God, heaven, hell, I can imagine someone like that not really being offended by this kind of material, but not finding it quite as funny because it's existentially a little bit more sensitive on that front.
To the degree that culture also shapes belief, not only reflects it, but shapes it. And The Far Side isn't the only example of this. The Simpsons cartoon certainly deals with religious themes on a regular basis, to great effect in humor, in my opinion. Charles Schulz even did this through Peanuts in a much more gentle way.
Mm-hmm.
To what degree is this representing kind of danger to American belief?
In the case of Gary Larson, I don't think it's a great danger. I may be wrong. One of the pleasant things about Gary Larson is that he's refrained largely from participating in the culture wars in a way that, and I think the Simpsons has been that way as well, for the most part. I think he jokes about evolution as much as he does about religion. He's not trying to belittle. I don't think he's trying to belittle the religious aspect, but just saying, hey, this is the public that I'm dealing with, and you know, some of it when you push it and when you take certain things literally, it's kind of funny. I may be overly optimistic, but I don't see Larson spelling the end of Christian America.
What would you say to someone who says, well, look, I take my religion seriously, and I take scriptures seriously, and I just can't see my way clear to laugh at something, a depiction of God or heaven or the devil or hell. What would you say?
Don't read more into Gary Larson's work than is there. If we didn't provide grist for the mill, so to speak, if we didn't allow these kind of silly notions, the sillier notions, I'm not saying that the idea of hell is silly. It's not silly at all. But if we allow these things to kind of sprout and grow, we don't really have anybody but ourselves to blame for people making fun of it. I mean, I think it's okay for us to make fun of the funny as well.
And is it funny also because there is a kernel of truth? Every joke seems to have that play of a kernel of truth.
Yeah, I think you're right. That if there's not an element of truth to some joke, then it's not going to resonate with people. So, yeah, I think that's right.
Dr. Patrick Gray teaches in the Department of Religious Studies at Rhodes College in Memphis, Tennessee. He has authored an article in the latest issue of Touchstone magazine titled Comic Belief. Dr. Gray, thanks for being our guest.
Thank you very much.
You know, I think it is. I think humor is probably, they say, used to say laughter is the best medicine. That's the old Reader's Digest thing. Not medicine, and certainly not therapy. Maybe sometimes it makes for good theology. If someone who has a sound theology can laugh at the vacuous, empty theology that they find in the culture, and this is a window into that. Now, it represents a serious problem, however, because all humor is based upon that kind of truth and conflict. It also highlights a real serious problem in what people believe. That's why we have a show like Issues, Etc., Talk Radio for the Thinking Christian. Maybe we could somehow also have Talk Radio for the Laughing Christian, but it doesn't work the same on radio. The comic strip doesn't work on radio, and I'm no comedian. Tomorrow on the program, Time Magazine has a cover story on Mary, the mother of Jesus. We'll be talking about that with David Van Bima of Time and Dr. Martin Noland of the Concordia Historical Institute. The same subject, both of those guests. And then on Thursday, Hating America and Ward Churchill with Dr. Gene Edward Veith of World Magazine. We'll also talk about Seder meals with Dr. Daniel Gard of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Christian Seder meals will be on the topic on the plate then Thursday on the program. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues at 7.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.